we have not had the chance to meet yet, my name is David. I'm part of the staff here at Severn. I'm also one of the elders at Severn. And today we get to continue our series called The One We've Waited For. We're actually in week 12 of the series. We've been here for a while. And we are closing in on Good Friday and Easter next weekend. So that means that this week we're going to be spending some time looking at an event in Jesus' life that happens right towards the end of his life. And in what we're going to read today, we're actually going to get a unique look at Jesus. Jesus is normally this picture of composure and peace, but today we're actually going to see him highly distraught. And in what we're going to read, we're actually going to be presented with two problems and one solution. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to read the passage to us today. It's Matthew 26, verses 36 through 46. Really easy to remember if you're wondering what text we're in. 26, 36, 46. So let me read for us, starting in verse 36. It says, "Then Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he told the disciples, 'Sit here while I go over there and pray.' Taking along Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. Then he said to them, 'My soul is swallowed up in sorrow to the point of death. Remain here and stay awake with me.' Going a little farther, he fell face down and prayed, 'My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will.' Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. He asked Peter, 'So couldn't you stay awake with me 1 hour? Stay awake and pray, so that you don't enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak.' Again, a second time, he went away and prayed, 'My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done.' And he came again and found them sleeping, because they could not keep their eyes open. After leaving them, he went away again and prayed a third time, saying the same thing once more. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, 'Are you still sleeping and resting? Look, the time is near. The Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up, let's go. See, my betrayer is near.'" So like I said, this passage presents us with two problems and one solution, and they're actually going to serve as our three main ideas today. The first thing we see is the problem of the cup, then we see the problem of our slumber, and then we see the one and only solution. So we're going to start off looking at our first main idea, which is the cup. Now, obviously the most unique thing we see in this passage is the great distress that Jesus is in. He, in fact, says he's swallowed up in sorrow to the point of death. So the obvious question, and really the most important question for us, is why? Why is Jesus in this, you know, place of such great distress and sorrow? And when you really think about it, it can't just be the fact that he knows his death is getting closer. It can't just be his physical death he's thinking about. He's been predicting that for a long time. He's been telling his disciples for a while now that he was going to be killed. So he knew his death was coming, so that can't, it can't just be the knowledge of his death that's bringing this on him. And it can't just be the physical pain either that he knows he's going to experience on the cross. We've actually, through all history since Jesus, seen many, many Christian martyrs who have seemed to have faced the, you know, terrible deaths, whether it's burning at the stake or being crucified themselves, seem to have faced that with more composure than Jesus has in this story today. So the question still remains, what is causing his distress? Why is he so full of sorrow? And the answer is actually in what he continually asks to be removed from him. It's the cup. Three times he says, "If at all possible, could this be removed from me?" So really, for us to understand the significance of what we're reading today, we have to understand, well, what is the cup? You know, what's the significance of the cup? And put simply, the cup is a metaphor for the wrath of God towards evil and sin. Everybody's favorite topic, the wrath of God. So I'll just give a couple of examples from the Old Testament that show kind of how we know this is what Jesus is referencing. There's many of these, but this is Isaiah 51:17. We read, wake yourself up, stand up, Jerusalem, you who have drunk the cup of his fury from the hand of the Lord, you who have drunk the goblet to the dregs, the cup that causes people to stagger. And then in Psalm 75:8, another example, we read, for there is a cup in the Lord's hand full of wine blended with spices, and he pours from it. All the wicked of the earth will drink, draining it to the dregs. So we generally, for obvious reasons, don't like the idea of the wrath or anger of God. A lot of us will either skip those verses, not think about them, try to avoid them. And I think the reason for that is when we read verses about God's wrath or when we think about God's anger, what can quickly jump into our mind are kind of these images of God as this God who's always angry. He's quick to fly off the handle, and he's happy to punish people who mess up. He's like waiting on the edge of his seat, just happily waiting to punish. And these are obviously, these are false images of God. That's not what he's like at all. I think our perception of God's anger or of God's wrath is actually often shaped by our experience of human anger and human wrath, which causes so much harm and so much devastation in our world. And even when we're upset about something legitimate, it is so often marred by revenge and spite to where even when we're upset about something we should be, we still are just, we don't bring about goodness through our anger or through our fury. But God is not like us. He's not like us. And his wrath is real, but it's not like our wrath. His wrath is always good and always right. God is actually a God who would define himself and is constantly called compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. So he's not quick to punish or quick to be angry. He's actually very quick to forgive. But because he's a God of love, it says he's slow to anger. It doesn't mean he has no anger just because he's a God of love. In fact, because he is a God of love, he has anger towards the evil and sin that would destroy that which he loves. So one of my favorite kind of succinct definitions of God's wrath that I read this week when researching was this. It's, God's wrath is his rightful expression of his holy love in the face of sin and evil. I'll read it one more time. God's wrath is his rightful expression of his holy love in the face of sin and evil. So it's actually because he's a God of love that he has wrath. Now, this might on the surface kind of sound like an oxymoron, like how can that exist at the same time? But I think when you really take the time to think about it, it makes a lot of sense. So when you look throughout the Bible, two of the most common things that bring about God's wrath are actually injustice and idolatry. And idolatry is often spoken of in terms of adultery, because Israel was God's covenant people. So they had a covenant relationship with God, just like a husband and wife through marriage have a covenant relationship. And when you think about, in our culture, even though our culture would reject the idea of moral absolutes and would define love oftentimes as just affection and affirmation of the other person, even in our culture, what would we say is the appropriate response to injustice or adultery? Anger. We would, even in our culture, we would still say anger is the appropriate response to those two things. Now, we obviously have to be careful. We don't always align with God on what is right or wrong. And again, our anger is often result in negative actions. But I think you get the point in that even we know that apathy towards injustice is not love. It's actually evil to be apathetic towards injustice. And apathy towards adultery is not love. If someone can be unfaithful to you or cheat on you, and you are completely unaffected and unmoved, that does not mean you love that person. It means they don't actually matter to you at all. So it's actually because he's a God of love that he also has anger or wrath towards that which would destroy what he loves. Now the question still kind of remains, well, what does his wrath look like? Whenever you read in the Old Testament, a lot of times, often, when God's wrath comes against his people, Israel, it's by him giving them over to their enemies. So it's this language of giving them over to their enemies. So for example, Israel would start to worship the idols or the gods of the surrounding nations. God would allow them to be conquered by the surrounding nations. He would give them over to their enemies. In the New Testament, you actually see the same language of giving over. You see it in Romans chapter 1, where Paul says the wrath of God is now revealed. It's revealed. So it's like, okay, we can see it now. What does it look like? In Romans 1, he says it looks like God giving people over to their desires. It actually says that those who are under wrath become wise in their own eyes, but are actually foolish. Their minds are darkened, and they are given over to a senseless mind to do what is wrong. So it's really interesting when you think about this idea of wrath is actually, when someone is under God's wrath, or when we're under God's wrath, we are actually just given over to follow our own path and to the consequence and the logical end of that path. Which, when you think about it, if God is the source, the creator and the source of all life, anytime we turn our back on him and head away from him, if God were, say, in the center right here, any path, the billions and millions of paths that can go away from him would all end in death. If he's life, every path away from God ends in death and ends in separation from him. So in a really sobering yet incredibly fair reality, Any time that God is giving us, and basically if those who turn their back on God are given over to exactly what they want, if they want nothing to do with God, that's exactly what they get. They get nothing to do with God. And this is why Jesus is so distraught. Because Jesus has never turned his back on his Father. Jesus has never walked away from him or disobeyed him or faced his Father's anger. He's never experienced wrath or separation from his Father. When you really think about it, we can't fully grasp the closeness between Jesus and the Father. That's something our minds just have real difficulty understanding, that for all of eternity, God the Father and God the Son have lived in harmony with one another, in perfect love with one another. So that when we start to grasp that, we can start to realize how painful this would have been for Jesus when he started to experience that separating. Because the longer your relationship has existed, the more painful it is, or the closer the relationship, the more painful it is when it's severed. And to try to wrap our minds around this, we can just think about, hey, when you hear in the world that people are dying every day, that can make you sad. You know, if you hear specific stories, it can affect you a little bit. But if you learn that one of your friends lost a family member, that'll affect you a little bit more because you're a little bit closer. You maybe even knew the family member, and you see the effect it has on your friend. But if you lose a family member, or if you lose a child, the pain of that can be crushing. And that's what we see Jesus experiencing. He's experiencing a separation from his Father. He's experientially understanding his Father's wrath for the first time here in the garden. Here's what's so incredible about this is here in the garden, he experientially knows how bad it's going to be on the cross. And yet, he still says, if there's no other way to save them, I'll do it. Seeing how affected Jesus is by this idea of being separated from his Father should give us pause for two reasons. First, just an intellectual reason, is that if you're still doubting whether or not these gospel accounts are reliable, just think for an instance, if you were trying to create a story, make something up to convince people that this guy was God, and then the church was going to be run by these guys like Peter, James, and John, would you have recorded this story about Jesus being so distraught and about the disciples constantly falling asleep on him? You probably would have left that one out if you were just making this up, which means it should give us pause to think, huh, there's only one reason to write that down. It's because it actually happened. These gospel accounts are reliable. So that's kind of the intellectual reason we should be given pause by this story, and many like it in the gospel accounts. But there's a second, more personal reason why this should give us pause, and it should make us ask the question, am I taking separation from God as seriously as Jesus does? Does it affect me or does it affect you the way it affects Jesus? Because if it did, if distance from God affected us that heavily, would we not be so much more passionate about drawing near this God who we want to be close to? And would we not be calling so many other people to do the same, draw near to this God? Because separation from him is the worst possible thing, but it doesn't affect us the same as it does Jesus. And there's a reason for that. It's actually the same reason that the disciples could be mere feet away from Jesus and they just really have no concept of really what he was going through. And it's that we are asleep. Just like the disciples, we're asleep. And that's the second problem, and the second main idea for us today is the slumber. So I'm going to read for us verses 40 and 41. It says, then he, Jesus, came to the disciples and found them sleeping. He asked Peter, so couldn't you stay awake with me 1 hour? Stay awake and pray so that you won't enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. So in this passage, we actually see two things that are repeated multiple times. We see Jesus praying multiple times, and we see his disciples sleeping multiple times. And when the Bible points something out in kind of repetitive nature, it's really important for you to sit up and take notice of why is it repeating this. And Jesus actually uses the physical sleep of his disciples to speak to a larger spiritual reality. He says, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Which is actually a pretty patient response from Jesus, but also reveals this larger reality that affects all of us, kind of a universal, something that's universally understood and really experienced by all of mankind, and that's that we are affected by a spiritual slumber. Even when we want to do what is right, we have a spiritual sleepiness about us. The disciples, actually, in the passage right before this one, had all just told Jesus, every single one of them had said, we would never abandon you, Jesus, no matter what. Even if we had to die, we're with you. And then he said, stay awake for an hour. And they were out. They were just out. They couldn't do it. So even when we want to do what is right, we still experience this sleepiness. And this has existed ever since sin entered the world in Genesis chapter 3. The Bible often talks of sleep really as sin or our sin natures in the idea of sleep. One example would be Jonah fleeing from God, and we're told that in the boat he goes down into a deep sleep. So me and my wife Shana, we have three children, Reese, Jonathan, and Trent, and we read to them every night before bed. My kids love reading before bed. And they're starting to enter this wonderful age where the books they enjoy are actually books I enjoy. So I'm a Dr. Seuss fan, but at a certain point it gets old. You got to get into better books. So what that means is now, right now, we're actually in the midst of it, we're reading The Hobbit. We're almost done. We got like two more chapters maybe. If you don't know about The Hobbit, I'm sorry. but I'll briefly catch you up to speed. So the synopsis is, you got the protagonist, Bilbo. He's a hobbit. He gets swept up into this adventure with a bunch of dwarves to go back to their homeland to reclaim their land and their treasure that had belonged to their people ages ago that had been taken by a dragon. So classic fantasy story. But along this journey, they encounter all sorts of different perils and different challenges they have to go through. And one of these is the Forest of Mirkwood, which is this enchanted, kind of mysterious forest. And they're given this advice before they go in, hey, don't leave the path, don't drink or touch any of the water. So of course, a little ways in, the largest dwarf, he's called Fat, like every time they talk about him, so you feel bad for him. His name's Bomber. He falls into the water and is completely unconscious, just falls asleep on the spot. So now his companions have to carry him on the path as they go, and we read this. It says, Bomber slept on with a smile on his fat face, as if he no longer cared for all the troubles that vexed them. And when Bomber finally wakes up, he has been dreaming of these feasts and all this food, and he was having these wonderful dreams, and he's actually forgotten the entire journey up to this point. All the perils they faced, he's totally forgotten it. So his friends have to basically convince him, like, no, we have no food. We're lost. We're in this forest. So as reality starts to settle in on poor Bomber, we read this. It says, he suddenly refused to go a step further and flung himself on the ground. Go on if you must, he said. I'm just going to lie here and sleep and dream of food. If I can't get it any other way, I hope I never wake up again. So in Bomber's situation, we see some of the effects of physical sleep, which is that it does not change your reality, just makes you completely unaware of it. And that when you're physically sleeping, you are helplessly in danger. You cannot help yourself to the danger around you. And lastly, you are extremely comfortable, and you don't want that to change. And this perfectly reflects on our spiritual reality. We are not aware of our situation, of our spiritual danger that's all around us, that we are completely helpless against. And we would oftentimes rather just remain kind of in an ignorance is bliss kind of attitude and not face the reality around us. And we actually see the effects of this sleep every single day of our lives. You know, why do you think it is so hard to do the right thing, even when you want to do the right thing? Why is it so hard to follow Jesus with any sort of focus? Why is it so hard to read your Bible? Why is it so hard to pray? Why is it so hard to be in community? Or why do we so often substitute and really trade out the real love, joy, and peace we desire? We just settle for cheap substitutes, even though we know they're cheap substitutes. Or why do we so regularly just distract ourselves or entertain ourselves, or medicate ourselves instead of face the reality around us? Now, I'll give one last what if, or why do you think, that kind of pertains to all of us right now. Why do you think that we can sit here on Sunday morning and talk about the cup of God's wrath and not be moved at all like Jesus was moved? And the answer is the same for all those questions. It's because we're asleep. And if we don't wake up, we'll end up just like Bomber in our little illustration there, in that he was completely oblivious to reality, completely detached from reality, which made him a burden to his friends. They had to carry him. He was a burden to the people around him, but maybe most importantly, he thought he was eating, but he was starving. And whenever you realize that that's exactly where we are spiritually with God, if you're just dreaming of food, you're wasting away. If you're not actually eating real food, you're wasting away. And all of us, in our natural state, we're just wasting away as we are not experiencing what we were made to experience, the satisfying presence of our Creator. Whenever the Apostle Paul is talking about this reality. He actually says in the book of Ephesians, he says, "Get up, sleeper, and rise up from the dead, and the Messiah will shine on you." What he's saying is, wake up so you can experience what you were actually made to experience. Turn back to God and come towards him. He will welcome you with open arms so that you can be refreshed in the presence of your Creator. So we have this problem of the cup, and then we have the problem even made even worse by the fact that we're asleep. We don't even know the cup is as big a problem as it really is, and we can't really deal with it. We're helpless because we're asleep, so what's the solution? That's our final idea today. I'm actually going to read this to us here, the second half of two verses. It's verses 39 and 42. This is Jesus' prayers where they're recorded. He says, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me, yet not as I will, but as you will." And then in verse 42 again, he says, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." So the event of Jesus in a garden is actually very different than another event that took place in a garden that's world famous. It's known as Adam in the Garden of Eden. And that is one of the parallels that you would notice here if you were reading the stories in the Bible as one whole story, as you would see, oh, they're both in a garden at these moments of real kind of like crisis in the history of mankind. But they're very different. And it kind of leads to the question, well, what is the difference between Jesus and Adam? And you actually get the answer in what Jesus continually repeats here. He says, "Your will be done. Your will be done. Your will be done." Which means that Jesus was completely surrendered to the will of his Father because he was completely convinced of the goodness of his Father. Completely convinced. He did not think his Father was holding out some better plan that he's not going to share with me because he's just, you know, being mean. You know, he knew that whatever plan the Father had for him was the best. Completely convinced of God's goodness. Adam did not view God that way. Adam actually believed the lie that all of us believe at some time or in a certain degree, kind of probably to a certain degree at most times in our lives, which is that God is holding out on us, that there is some good outside of his will that he just doesn't want us to have. That's the lie that we so often believe. So if we're in the same boat as Adam and we're not convinced of the goodness of God, how do we wake up? How do we wake up to the goodness of God? And the answer is actually pretty simple. It's the same thing that woke up the disciples in our story today. It's Jesus. Really, all of our popular stories nowadays, really all of them that have any kind of longevity, have this aspect to them where there's a hero who kind of comes from outside the problem, maybe it's not even his problem in the first place, who steps in and he saves the day, usually at great risk to himself. This could be anything from, you know, Harry Potter, the Avengers, Lord of the Rings. Still today, that storyline carries so much weight with us. Those are the stories that stick out to us, where a hero is willing to risk himself or sacrifice himself to solve a problem that probably wasn't even his. And the reason for that is because there's this deep desire in all of us that has existed since Adam failed. Whether you know it or not, you've been waiting for a hero who would actually do what Adam didn't do. You're waiting for a hero to come and fix things. And what we see in our story today is it didn't end on a happy note. The passage I read today did not end on a happy note, but it did end on a hero's note. Whenever it becomes clear there is not another way to save us, Jesus' response is to wake up his disciples and say, "Get up, let's go." And he wasn't running from the problem. He was running to the cross. He knew where he was going. He knew what he was doing. So this story shows us that there is someone who's wide awake, who's able to deal with our problem of the cup and is able to wake us up at the same time, and his name is Jesus. I'm going to call up the worship team. We're actually going to wrap up here. But in the story of Adam in the garden, we had someone who disobeyed. Adam disobeyed despite the perfection of Eden. Everything was perfect, and he still disobeyed. In the story of Jesus, we have someone who obeyed, chose to obey, despite the terror of Gethsemane. And in Adam, what you have is somebody who, if he'd had obeyed, would have had life. Obedience led to life for Adam if he had just chosen to obey. For Jesus, he chose to obey knowing full well that his obedience led to death and led to him drinking the cup of God's wrath, of his Father's wrath, that belonged to us, drinking it down every last drop so there's not even a sip left for you and me. there really is no greater demonstration of God's love or of God's goodness than this picture of Jesus taking the cup on our behalf. Now, if you're here today and you're listening and you're just thinking, I still don't like the idea of a God of wrath. I still don't like that at all. I would just leave you with this. If there is no wrath, no judgment, no anger due our sin, then how much does it really cost that God to love you? Nothing. It costs him nothing to love you. But the God of the Bible does not just tell you he loves you. He actually does something about it. So God's wrath is real, which means that his love is costly. The more we understand his wrath, our understanding of his love will actually grow. It's directly correlated. His love is costly. So when we see this fact that Jesus didn't have to solve this problem for us, there was just no other way for us to be saved. It's not his problem, but he decided to step in, the Father and the Son together, saying, we'll do it. It's worth it for them, for you, for me. Let that wake you up to the reality of God's goodness. And let that wake you up to become a person who is willing to face reality, no matter how difficult it actually is. A person who's actually a blessing to those around you instead of a burden to those around you. And let that wake you up to become a person who actually has life, like we've been made to live, who's actually satisfied, who lays aside all the distractions and all the cheap substitutes that we're so easily drawn to. Let the goodness of God wake you up to the fact that his will really is best, because he really is good. So in Jesus, we have this hero. We have the one who surrendered his life for us so that we can surrender our lives to him, so that with him we can say, not my will, but yours be done. And if we do that, if we surrender our lives to this hero, it will not be as comfortable as a life of sleep. But it will be the life that we were made for. Let me pray for us, and we'll close. Father, my prayer today, our prayer today, God, I just would pray that you would wake us up. My words can't make that happen. We can't just muster up the courage inside of us to wake up. God, we need your help, and we just pray that you would do it. That you would wake us up to the reality of just how desperate our situation really is, how bad we need your help, and how willing you are to offer help. Help us to see your goodness and to live in light of that and to just know that you really are better than we imagine. Thank you for loving us. We love you. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.